Hello, this is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Yay!
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In 1979, an idea was floated to build a dome over Winooski. As the idea gained traction, Al Bowright, who worked in the state legislature at the time, wrote a song to celebrate the concept.
Dome over Winooski, so fair and so true.
Today on Vermont Edition, we're listening back to a show on failed Vermont ideas that first aired back in 2013. And then, like now, we can report there is no dome over the Onion City. That's just one, though, of the failed Vermont ideas we hear about from our guests. Tom Slayton, editor emeritus of the now-defunct Vermont Life magazine and a former VPR commentator, and author and journalist Mark Bushnell. Let's dive into the conversation with perhaps Vermont's greatest, most epic failed idea, that Winooski Dome. I asked Tom Slayton the only question you can ask about such an idea. What were they thinking?
It came during the heyday of domes, proposed by or designed by and promoted by Buckminster Fuller. I can't remember who proposed it, but basically they wanted to cover the entire little city of Winooski with a dome and make it special that way and attract national attention. Well, the idea, for fairly obvious reasons, never went anywhere. But I think what it was at its core was a way of saying, you know, Winooski used to be kind of the urban slum of Burlington, and it was a way of saying, our town is great, our town is special, Winooski is a good place. And in point of fact, now Winooski is a pretty vibrant little subset of the larger greater Burlington area.
Well, and as I understand it, go ahead, Mark, it was also supposed to be an environmental thing.
Yeah, it was during the energy crisis, and they were hoping, proponents were saying that it would cut the city's heating demands by 90%. So, you know, I think that it's easy to laugh at, but there were people who took it quite seriously. I mean, they got a conference together at St. Michael's, and as a keynote speaker, they had Buckminster Fuller, the father of the geodesic dome, show up. And it got national attention. I mean, as Tom was saying, they were trying to shine a light on Winooski for a change, and they got in Time magazine because of it. I mean, granted, it was probably a slightly humorous article about it, but it got some attention.
Yeah, they even wrote a white paper about it, which we tried to get from the Winooski City Clerk, and unsuccessfully, but we may still keep trying because we're interested in seeing what that says. And as you said, Buckminster Fuller came from Brazil, where he was working on creating Brasilia, the capital there, and came to Vermont. So it sounds like this idea did have some traction and even had some defenders years after it sort of petered out, you know, that people still thought, hey, in terms of environmentalism, not having to heat with any wood, not having any internal combustion engines within the dome could still be a good idea. Did it have any merit?
Well, I think it raises some interesting questions. First of all, solar gain can be a detriment as well as a good thing. Suppose they built a dome over Winooski and we had 2 weeks of really hot sunshine and they baked the city dry.
One of the plus sides what people were saying was that you wouldn't need a road crew to do snow plowing.
That's right. Yes, and we wouldn't have to, you know, pay all that money to heat our homes. It would be great. Well, we got another idea, a note and a picture from Meg, who actually posted it on our Facebook page. It's a picture of a dirigible station in Barton, and it was a postcard mailed from Barton to Wes Glover in 1902. And Meg says, I don't know how much of a plan this actually was, but I do like the artist's vision. Dirigible service from Barton, Vermont to the North Pole. So I've been picturing all day getting in my dirigible, headed to the North Pole, you know, coming out of the subway station that they also have in Barton, Vermont in this photo. Another idea that perhaps didn't fly. You wanted to say something?
I think those postcards were actually fairly widespread. They were not just Barton, but, they drew blimps and magical flying devices and subways and strange roadways and elevated trains and so forth. Huh. In many rural parts of the country, it was a kind of a joke.
So not so serious. Nobody actually thought you were going to have dirigible service from
or
Barton
subway
to
service.
The North Pole. I still like the vision. And let's go to Nicholas, who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Nicholas. Go ahead.
Well, I was talking about a failed idea of the 1920s when Rest Orton, who was leading a movement to separate Vermont from the rest of the Union, because the rest of the Union was going to pieces, suggested that we would need an outlet to the sea and that we could negotiate that with New Hampshire to get out, I suppose, to Portsmouth. And when asked what would happen if New Hampshire disagreed, he simply said we would raise an army and conquer the state and take it for ourselves.
Wow, Nicholas, I hadn't heard about that one. How did you learn about that?
Well, because I was working on the 1920s, and I came across a series of articles on Rest Orton on the original ideas of Vermont independence.
I see. So is this Nicholas Clifford?
Yes.
Ah, yes. Historian Nicholas Clifford from Middlebury, written a book on the 1920s, the floods in Vermont, as well as many other things. Thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. And Nicholas, they're talking about a way to the sea for Vermont. And Tom Slayton, Mark Bushnell, I also want to talk about these proposed canals that were supposed to cross the state of Vermont. There were a couple of different proposals that would go from the Connecticut River eventually to Lake Champlain. Mark, can you tell us about some of those canal plans?
Yeah, Vermonters caught sort of a bad case of canal fever in the 1820s. I think the reason was that they'd seen the success of the Champlain Canal, which, you know, as everyone knows, is at the bottom of Lake Champlain. It connects to the Hudson and ultimately to New York and the New York City market. And right 2 years later, there was a 360-mile canal finished, the Erie Canal, the famous one that mm-hmm. was completed across New York State. And everyone thought that would be a great way to bring merchandise and people across the state. And I think there might have been, to some extent, people in the eastern part of the state feeling they were being left behind by the, you know, the Champlain Canal that was going to put all the emphasis on the west side of the state. So there were these dreams of connecting the major water bodies, Lake Champlain and Lake Memphremagog, with a couple different canals. They would create, ultimately, if these had gone through, a chain of waterways between Boston and Montreal. I mean, it does seem rather ludicrous in hindsight, because there was the matter of the Green Mountains to deal with.
Right. Although, you know, you think if you've ever driven along the New York State Thruway all the way across New York, you hit these locks from the Erie Canal and you realize what a feat of engineering that was. And it doesn't seem that outrageous to think we could have had a canal system just to cross Vermont.
Well, I mean, to give you an example, there was a 61-mile route that was considered between the Connecticut River and Lake Memphremagog, and it would have required an elevation gain in some places of 1,200 feet.
Oh, if you can imagine how hard difficult. It is.
Well, yeah, and there was another spot where they were trying to avoid going over a hill that was inconveniently placed in Walden, and the engineers seriously considered digging a 2-mile-long tunnel in the 1820s. I mean, eventually this idea sort of died because people could see what was coming. I mean, why put all this effort in when it looked like railroads would have so much more effect when they, you know, because they were sort of on the horizon and they seemed like a much better way of annihilating time and distance, which is, you know, the goal of the canals.
And Tom Slayton, I understand that was also perhaps the reason why another canal plan up through Canada, it just sort of failed at the end because technology was moving forward. We didn't need canals so much anymore.
Yeah, there was, I think you may be referring to what they call the Chambly mm-hmm. Canal and the Lake Champlain Barge Canal. And when I was in college, that was being promoted as a big deal that would economically invigorate the state, creating basically a canal that would go out the Richelieu River and the St. Lawrence and provide Vermont sea access that way. And a friend of mine said, well, Vermont's got, I said, that sounds like a terrible idea. It would bring industrial development and so forth right to our doorstep here in Burlington. And a friend of mine said, well, Vermont's got plenty of scenic beauty. We need some industry here. So, it was an idea that I think the juice went out of it when they realized that barge traffic and tanker traffic was definitely not suitable for Vermont and was fading anyway.
Anne's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hi. Love your show. in the 70s, I think it was 1977, the UNICEF committee in Burlington had the bright idea of putting on a recycled architecture show at the Fleming Museum. It was phenomenal, blah, 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 blah. And then we had a little seminar on the future of Burlington, and I think it was John Anderson, the architect, who came up with the dome over Winooski.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that answers your thing. My idea was to put belts around people so we could just rocket wherever we wanted to get to. And back then, someone said, oh, the Army's working on that right now. So there you go. I didn't see that either.
And when you had those ideas, like put belts on people, you know, have them strap a little engine on and we can just whiz through the air, you know, this is sort of George Jetson-like thinking. Did you think it might really come to fruition? And was that your real vision of the future?
Well, you know, I've had polio since I was about 18 months old, and I think that factored into it. But I used to have dreams of having the wind pick me up and carry me to wherever I wanted to go and just plop me, you know, down the street. And so that was. But the thing that blew me away was that someone at the panel, and I don't know how accurate it was, said that that the Army was working on something like that. So obviously somebody didn't think it was feasible. Because
too bad.
I haven't seen any in the local Walmart or 5 and 10 or whatever.
Right. Anne, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate that. And, you know, maybe it'll still happen someday. Let's talk about another idea that failed, but, you know, isn't as far out as having rockets attached to us so that we can fly. This is the Green Mountain Parkway, still remembered by many as a failed idea, but was supposed to put a road through the Green Mountains, a scenic road. And, Tom, that didn't actually happen, but there's still some debate over whether or not it would have at least been successful.
Well, it's an interesting idea. It was proposed back in the depths of the Depression in the 1930s by a man named William Wilgus, who later donated the land for Wilgus State Park. But Wilgus wanted to have a road that would go the length of the state from Massachusetts up to Jay Peak, and he got it pretty far along. He got a lot of support in Vermont and a lot of support in Washington. And this was the era of the Depression, and Washington was putting a lot of money into economic rehab projects and that sort of thing. But it immediately created a lot of opposition in Vermont as well. And the opposition came from two or three places, not geographic places, but two or three ideas. And one was that the people in the South, southern Vermont, opposed it because they were sure that the proposed highway would go all the way to the north, take all the traffic and all the business all the way to northern Vermont. The other was that we're going to screw up the Green Mountains. We're going to create a highway that would pave over the tops of the Green Mountains. Well, in fact, the highway would not have gone over the tops of most of the Green Mountains, and I think it would have gone over Glastonbury Mountain, but it would have gone along the sides of the main range, a lot of the main range, and in places like Mount Mansfield, it was 10 miles away from the mountains. You had a view of the mountains. It would have ended on Jay Peak, and a sort of national park was proposed for Jay Peak. And a friend of mine, Bruce Post, has suggested that had the road actually been built, the mountains might be more free of development than they are today. Another reason it was overtly opposed was we don't want the federal government telling us what to do in Vermont. We don't want their money. We don't want their plans. And that's a longstanding Vermont motif. The other is a covert form of oppression, of expression that is not widely recognized in Vermont, but I think that Bruce Post and others have come across, and that's anti-Semitism. Hmm. The people who opposed the road, in many cases, didn't want the quote-unquote wrong kind of people, unquote, to come to Vermont to vacation. And there were a lot of code words used to describe the wrong kind of people, but in many cases it was clear that they meant immigrants, Jews, and other people that were quote-unquote not like us.
Huh. I didn't know that piece of it. That's really interesting. We got a note from Jared in Lincoln on this who says, you know, I think any of us that have been on the Blue Ridge Parkway or Skyline Drive can agree that they're stunningly beautiful roads with sweeping vistas, unique architectural features, and a chance to slow down. These roads also give the opportunity for people unable to hike the chance to be in the mountains. I think if the Green Mountain Parkway had been built, we'd probably be so used to it now that it wouldn't be an issue, and it would probably be considered one of the great scenic highways of our country. So failed idea, but Jared says if it had happened, we probably would be celebrating it.
The reason it didn't get built was that it was after the legislature considered it, voted it down, but decided to have a referendum, a statewide referendum on the issue. Vermonters voted it down 42,000 to 30,000.
Wow.
Yeah, that's 58% to 42%.
So not super close.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because I think the legislature was really tied up about this. I mean, the Senate had approved it, and then the House defeated it 126 to 111. So if 8 votes had gone the other way, they just would have outright approved it. And I think it came down so close, and they just didn't know. So that's why they went to the referendum process. I mean, we don't have a real referendum process, but they had this sort of backdoor way to get a public opinion poll, essentially.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today, we're listening back to a discussion with writers Mark Bushnell and Tom Slayton about failed Vermont ideas, from domes to canals to roads. I asked Mark Bushnell about one road in particular, the Bailey Hazen Military Road, a Revolutionary War-era plan to connect Newbury, Vermont to St. John's, Quebec. Turns out, it was the traffic coming the other way that presented the ultimate roadblock.
I guess it seemed a good idea at the time to the people who supported it. It was 1776, and the Continental Army needed a supply route because there were there was an attempted invasion of Canada that had gotten bogged down, and they needed reinforcements and resupply. A guy named Jacob Bailey, the first half of the name of the road, was one of the first settlers in Newbury, and he came up with the idea, why not cut a road from Wells River to St. John's, Quebec, because that would cut 70 miles off the water route they would have had to take to get across the state and up Lake Champlain. He got permission from Washington. Washington decided to okay it without asking Congress. He said they were too busy with other matters. And so he said, go ahead and do this, pay for it yourself, and we'll reimburse you. And so Bailey hired 110 guys and paid them partly, interestingly enough, in food and rum to keep working. And they cut this 90-mile road. I mean, that was the plan. That had to be as wide as a cart through the wilderness, if you can imagine how hard that was.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the construction in wet spots was corduroy roads, which is you cut down trees, you limb them, you line them up, and you cover them with dirt just to so it doesn't bog down too much. And in 6 weeks, they'd gotten more than half the way there. And then Bailey gets this startling letter from Washington saying, guess what? Things are not looking so good in Washington. In fact, our guys are retreating or are thinking about retreating, or they might be doing it already because they didn't know what was going on to the north. And oops, you know, maybe the British are going to be following them down here. They suddenly, this great idea of getting this route into the heart of Canada, you know, they put it the other way. Like you said before, it's like they realized, oh, this could be a two-way road. You can use it either way. So they, in a way, they were saying, oh, no, we're building this highway so that the British can come down here and hook up with existing roads and get all the way down to Boston. Ugh. So this could have just been this horrible idea. And interestingly enough, Washington writes this letter saying, well, it's up to you, but, you know, you might want to cancel the road, you know. And not surprisingly, Bailey agreed. And also, perhaps not surprisingly, he never got reimbursed for all the money he put into building the road.
And Hazen, where does he come in?
He came in later. It was 2 years later, and the colonies were thinking again about invading Canada. I guess this time convinced that it was going to be a one-way road and going to stay a one-way road. I don't know. And so Hazen oversaw continued construction of the road. It never actually made it into Canada, but interestingly enough, if you look along that road on a map where it is, a lot of towns grew up along it afterwards because after the war, it was an easy way for people to come up and settle.
Well, and it lives on today in the blue cheese, Bailey Hazen blue cheese from Jasper Hill Creamery. A lovely blue cheese, perhaps not such a lovely road. Tom?
Not a failed idea.
And if you go to Hazen's Notch, which is a northern notch in the Green Mountains, there's a little granite monument that marks the end of the Bailey Hazen Road in the notch.
So you can still see where it would have been.
Where it ended.
Tom, what about the Pyramid Mall in Williston? This is one that many people alive today will probably remember.
Yeah. Pyramid Mall was proposed by the Pyramid Company back in 1977, and it was going to be a huge multi-store mall at Taft's Corners, which is on the outskirts of Burlington. And when I was young, Taft's Corners was farmland, and there was a farm right at Taft's Corners, the Taft Farm. And it gradually got developed and sold, and the farm went out of business, as so many farms did in the 60s and 70s. And suddenly it's prime developable land, and the Pyramid Company moved to develop it. Well, when it was proposed, it would have been the biggest commercial mall that Vermont had ever seen, and it provoked a lot of opposition, and was eventually defeated rejected in Act 250 hearings. I think the reason was that it would have pulled too much business out of downtown Burlington and theoretically turned Burlington into a ghost town. So the mall was defeated, but if you go there today, the irony of Pyramid Mall is there are probably more stores there and more acreage developed there than would have been if the Pyramid Mall had been developed. And it's been done piecemeal, essentially, after a big fight after Walmart came in.
Let's go to Raymond, who's calling in from Plattsburgh. Hi, Raymond. Go ahead.
Hi there. Well, there are two things that have always been in the wind for at least the past 50 or 60 years I know of. One is the Lake Champlain Bridge from Cumberland Head across Grand Isle rather than the ferry service. And the second was the Northern Interstate, which was supposed to go from Watertown across through Vermont, New Hampshire, and into Maine. And both of those were in development, but seemed to have fallen by the wayside. And thirdly, we are now hearing about the pipeline under Lake Champlain to go down to New York City to carry gas and oil. So I'll just leave those out there.
Raymond, thanks for your call. Yes, certainly ideas floating now that we don't know whether in 10 or 20 or 100 years we would be doing a show about them or not. Lots of big ideas happening around here that could be failed ideas of the future. Let's go to Charles in East Montpelier. Hi, Charles. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I remembered back in the late 60s, early 70s, the plan to dam up Victory Bog and turn it into a giant reservoir. And they were trying to sell it for a big recreation to replace the wildlife that was going to be lost. So I wonder if either Mark or Tom remember this and can comment on that.
Yeah, Charles,
thanks
for the call.
I remember it very well. That it was a U.S. Corps of Engineers project and proposed project. And as Charles, I believe that was Charles Johnson said, it was proposed as a recreational asset to the Northeast Kingdom. And people around the state and including in the Northeast Kingdom opposed it because they liked the wild bog just the way it was. As a matter of fact, I worked for the Rutland Herald at the time, and a friend of mine, Tony Bland, and I went up and pitched a tent in the middle of the winter and camped out in February in the bog. We wrote articles and essays about what a wonderful place it was. And in fact, today, that bog is an attraction to birders and naturalists and hikers, and there are wonderful trails, and you can see birds in Victory Bog that you'd see almost nowhere else in Vermont.
You know, when I hear about bogs and damming things, it's still remarkable to me to think about the many communities around the country and in Canada where they flooded to make reservoirs and flooded villages. And, you know, if you were to scuba dive down there now, you'd still see old home structures and, you know, the boundaries of where homes and fields were. I find that amazing that those ideas actually went through.
Well, Waterbury Reservoir flooded a little village.
Well, and the Wrightsville Reservoir, there's named after the village of Wrightsville, which is underneath it. They took the buildings out, though, so don't get too spooked out.
Yeah. Good. Although, yeah, you sort of imagine a whole town underneath on the floor bed of the pond, you know, just continuing on as it once was. Mark, you know, we talk on this show sometimes about the two presidents that Vermont has had, and we don't want to forget Chester A. Arthur. So two presidents that were born in Vermont. But what about failed presidential bids here?
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing. I mean, we do have two presidents, but only one of them ever got elected. I mean, both Coolidge and Chester Arthur got in because the presidents ahead of them, I mean, they got elected as vice presidents. And and they died. The presidents died, so they advanced. And Arthur never ran for re-election, unlike Coolidge. But we've had folks like Stephen Douglas of Brandon, who was a U.S. senator, and he had the misfortune of running against a guy named Lincoln. We have Admiral George Dewey of Montpelier, who became a war hero, known, you know, just nationally and internationally during during the Spanish-American War. And naturally, people thought, well, he's a great leader of men. Let's run him for president. And unfortunately, he was, you know, everything he was as a military leader, he lacked as being a presidential candidate. He admitted he'd never voted before. He said that the job of president looked easy. All he had to do was follow the orders of Congress. I mean, I think he really didn't understand sort of where the buck stopped. And George Aiken even considered running against Franklin Roosevelt in 1940. But, you know, Aiken was a pretty smart politician and knew that I think that was probably a bad fight to pick. And then, of course, there's Howard Dean, whose thwarted ambition was enough to make him scream. But so, you know, in a way, you know, being from Vermont, you know, except for those two noticeable examples, I mean, it's Vermont is a little bit where presidential aspirations go to die.
That was Tom Slayton and Mark Bushnell on Vermont Edition back in 2013, talking about some of the greatest, wildest, and strangest failed Vermont ideas. We're pulling from the Vermont Edition archives today to listen back to some of the greatest, strangest, most head-scratching ideas to come out of the state of Vermont. We just finished listening to a 2013 show that talked about some of the grandest failed Vermont ideas, and that got us thinking about some of the unusual other things we've covered on this show over the years. Now, if you ask anyone to name popular Vermont exports, they'll probably answer maple syrup, maybe cheese, maybe Ben and Jerry's or fish. But back in 2009, Vermont Edition producer and now VPR News Director Sarah Ashworth discovered an effort to add something new to the list of Vermont-made exports. Sticks. Yes, sticks. The things that, you know, hang off a tree, slightly smaller than a branch, attached to a leaf or two. Ashworth found a trio of enterprising Vermonters packaging and selling sticks and specifically marketing them to out-of-state dog owners. They called the company Fetch Sticks, and they were 100% pure Vermont stick.
Every idea for a new product has a story behind it. In the case of Fetch Sticks, the story involves three friends sitting around a sugar house in southern Vermont. While the sap boiled, they imbibed a potent concoction known locally as Mr. Fister's.
Basically, you take a ladle of the sap out of the boiling sap before it gets into syrup, and you put it in a mug, and then you put a little wild turkey in there. And so that kind of got the story going a little bit, and we just were fooling around trying to come up with an idea for a dog toy, actually. This seemed like a good idea, and we thought, well, what about real sticks?
That's one of the would-be entrepreneurs, Landgrove artist Anna Dibble. The other two are Dorset businessmen, Norman Levitz and Neil Riley. Levitt says the three knew it might be a bit presumptuous to charge people for a product that literally grows on trees.
At some point in the thought process, the pet rock came to mind, and we knew we had a winning idea.
Levitz and Dibble are longtime Vermont residents, but Riley is a relatively new transplant from New York City. And as he says, he was sitting out in the sticks when he realized something Vermonters might not. Sticks are a rare commodity in some places.
As being a city person and having a dog, I thought it was an ingenious idea because when you're in the city, you don't have a toy. You don't have access to sticks. You have rocks and what do dogs love? They love sticks to chase, to chew.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we just sort of started thinking sticks. Why not?
Mock them if you like, but consider this. The three friends have sold thousands of bundles of Vermont sticks in more than 30 states and Canada, and they're actually making a profit. Part of the reason for their early success is that they had a solid infrastructure already in place. Dibble's husband runs a post and beam construction company, and Levitz and Riley are co-owners of Wagatha's, an organic dog biscuit business. But even so, Riley says it's not exactly easy to sell sticks.
The amazing thing is there's actually a fair amount of labor and work involved. We go to trade shows with these things and people say, sticks, how can you be selling sticks? I have a backyard full of sticks. But you know, they have to be sourced, they have to be cut, they have to be, you know, brought back, sanded, sized, and put together. So it is a real business.
And the business begins by finding the perfect saplings. And to do that, you have to be able to see the sticks for the trees.
Let's see. This one over here looks pretty good to me. Although, Yeah, no, this would be fine. Yeah, that's about the right width.
It has to be maple. And then it has to be the right dimensions. And, you know, it has to be free of surface imperfections like cracks and things of that nature.
Many of the saplings are collected on Dibble's own property or that of her friends and neighbors. The three owners say they're mindful of harvesting the wood in a sustainable way. Workers at Dibble's husband's company do most of that gathering, and then on rainy days when they can't build, they'll head to Dibble's basement and cut the saplings. And that's exactly what worker Danny Weatherald is doing.
We have two different sizes. That's an 11-inch size. If we want to cut an 8-inch, we slide the saw over. And then after they're cut, we come over here to the sander. We sand the edges smooth, like this. And into the bend they go.
But the three friends say a perfectly sized and sanded stick is just half the battle. You still need to develop a good throwing technique. And that's why they've developed an illustrated instruction manual designed by Dibble. It even includes her home phone number for technical assistance. And as Dibble and Levitz demonstrate with her dog Pepper, the instructions really do start from the beginning.
Remove one stick from bundle. Yep. Grip stick firmly in left or right hand. Now, instruct dog to wait and ask dog to sit.
Sit.
If dog won't sit, bribe with a pig's ear. Swing arm back as far as it will go. Bend your elbow. Propel the arm forward with great force. Oh. Let go of the stick and yell, fetch!
The price for those instructions and three sticks is about $10. Levitz says he knows some may scoff at the figure. But he says they're only taking into account the raw materials, not the cost of the harvesting or all that sawing and sanding, not to mention transportation and distribution costs. The three owners say they know most of their stick buyers won't be Vermonters, though as Dibble says, they're definitely selling the Vermont brand.
This product, I think, is pretty essential Vermont, you know, that's one of the reasons that we thought it would be a good idea, actually. It would be hard to do this in another state, I think.
Right. New Jersey sticks just don't have the same cachet.
No, they don't.
That Vermont cachet may mean something to a dog's owners, but it's a safe bet that a dog doesn't really care as long as it's got a stick to fetch.
That was VPR News Director Sarah Ashworth back in 2009 when she was a Vermont Edition producer, reporting on Vermont fetch sticks. Sadly, Fetch Sticks is no more. Well, the company anyway. Still plenty of sticks, though. Neil Riley says his business now focuses on dog biscuits. The sticks, he says, became too big a hassle, and they stopped selling them in 2011. The entrepreneurs behind that product weren't the first to try to capitalize on something that grows on trees. For centuries, Vermont has reaped a harvest of green bucks, that is, thanks to our state's fall foliage. Back in 2015, Vermont Edition producer Rick Sangeri caught up with two men looking to turn those colorful leaves into a moneymaker. They formed the Vermont Leaf Company and literally sold bags of about a dozen leaves for $20 each bag. A box of 50 leaves ran for about $40. The pair collected the leaves in the woods and then vacuum sealed them in plastic bags and sent them off to customers as far away as New Mexico and California. We caught up to the brain trust behind the idea as they collected leaves in Zemanski Park in South Burlington.
My name is Frank Davis. I'm the creator and founder of the Vermont Leaf Company.
My name is Uwe Heist. I'm a co-founder of the Vermont Leaf Company. When Frank said we should ship leaves, I said, this makes perfect sense. Let's just do it.
There's so many different ways that people could make use of this. An office space where everybody's in a cubicle. I mean, I'm sure that would brighten some faces to be able to just strew leaves across. I can even see it at weddings instead of, you know, flower petals. A very Vermont wedding kind of thing where people are just doing leaves.
Yeah, beautiful. So here it's only maple, but in some areas you also have some oak trees, and they also have some nice color contrast, like a very dark, intense red, almost a little bit waxy on the surface. And then if you combine this with a regular green leaf, it's a stunning contrast.
It's almost like flavors, you know, this is like lemon lime and, you know, cherry, and I'm always on the lookout for grape. I mean, here's, look, but that's almost like a Merlot, you know?
Yeah, a nice side effect is I started dreaming in intense colors. Usually, like, I'm happy to have like one or two colors in my dreams, but this is now a firework of colors every night. And I think it just comes by interacting with leaves so much. You know, it's just there. It's on your mind all the time.
It's therapeutic. It's gorgeous. It has its own really precious value. It's almost totemic. The leaf itself is an archetype. So why don't you start putting something together? I'll give you some green. There's some cherry. Yeah. Orange.
Nice, yeah.
Lemon.
Oh, what a contrast.
Right?
Yeah. So I think we'll arrange again, like, complementing colors. And here, very intense and small red leaf. It's a nice accent. We're right between the green and the yellow. It's nice, huh?
Yeah, I think you're doing fine.
Thank you for the encouragement. Well, actually, I'm serious. I'm really intrigued by this because I really believe it can help other people. You know? Because it helps us just doing this work, and I imagine somebody else having a similar experience when they get the leaves. Not only are we sorting the leaves out, we're sorting all kinds of issues out while we do this. Yeah. Our vacuum machine doesn't really work well with Ziploc bags. So we have a special process that we borrowed from Orange is the New Black. We use a straw to suck the air out, and it works wonderfully. It might be an occupational hazard. These leaves are natural products, right? So probably good for you. A lot of, like, you know...
That's right.
Yeah, natural bacteria.
That maple decay.
Looks good.
That was Vermont Edition producer Rick Singeri back in 2015 with the deciduous duo of Frank Davis and Uwe Heiss selling Vermont's fall foliage. Frank Davis says they sold more than $500 worth of leaves that first year, but the orders soon petered out and he hasn't sold any since the first fall. But he says the company is still going and he plans to retool the business as an online store for all things leafy. And he says bags and boxes of Vermont leaves will still be on offer. Today we're looking back on some of the most head-scratching ideas to come out of Vermont. Before we go, let's pluck one more idea, or biography in this case, from the archives, and end with a success story. For years, UVM political science professor Garrison Nelson wanted to write a book about one of the most important political figures no one had ever heard of, or at least not very many remember, former Speaker of the House John McCormick, a Massachusetts congressman whose career spanned the presidencies of Calvin Coolidge on to Richard Nixon. Vermont Edition host Bob Kinzel spoke with Nelson about this idea for a biography on McCormick that Nelson refused to let fail, even after the book was rejected by nearly a dozen publishers.
The reason there were no biographies about him was because he didn't want one, and he did everything in his power to make sure he didn't get one. And here are some of the steps he took. He told his staff, nobody is ever to write anything about, you know, our time together. Nobody. Made that very clear. Two, they sanitized the papers. His papers were at Boston University, my alma mater, and they've been sanitized. There's virtually nothing before 1950, for example, in his papers. Lots of, birthday cards he sent to his wife, but not much in the way of real substantive materials.
Garrison, during the early part of his congressional career when Franklin Roosevelt is president, John McCormick is a pretty enthusiastic New Deal Democrat, isn't he? What does that tell us about the way he viewed the role of government?
A very activist. His family grew up in tremendous poverty. As they say, he had eight siblings. You know, five died young by the time he was 21. Five of them had deceased. He saw government as a very positive influence in terms of providing housing, in terms of Social Security and Medicare. He was on the Ways and Means Committee that wrote Social Security in 1935. His amendments were carried in the 1939 version of Social Security. He was Speaker of the House during the Medicaid debates in the mid-60s. The largest housing project in New England was built in South Boston, and at one point was even named for John McCormick's mother. So grueling poverty that he grew up with, that the family was forced him to drop out of school after the eighth grade, for example. That was the highest level of education he possessed was eighth grade, because he had to go sell newspapers, you know, for the family and work as a messenger boy for Western Union. So he knew real poverty. I mean, a lot of these politicians are talking about how poor they were. John's stories of poor boy were absolutely true. And he felt very akin to poor boys. So if you wanted to succeed with John McCormick, you gave him a poor boy story, and he would, you know, move, you know, heaven and earth to help you out.
Garrison, there was a lot of controversy in 1944 as FDR was seeking a fourth term in office about who would be his vice presidential running mate. It was a very important decision because FDR was not in good health at all. What role does McCormick play in this debate?
Just to show you how bad it was, days before the convention met, Dr. Frank Leahy of the Boston Leahy Clinic, which he founded, was one of two doctors, went to meet with Roosevelt's doctor, looked at the x-rays, did extensive physical examination of FDR, and Leahy concluded that FDR was going to die. And he said he's not going to survive a fourth term. And there should be great care, you know, devoted to picking a vice president. And this is in the letter. Now, this is a letter he wrote to himself, which was locked up for years, given to his secretary. She put it in her safe deposit box, and it was hidden for years until about 4 or 5 years ago when the Boston Globe released it. And FDR's private doctor, McIntyre, would not tell Roosevelt of these results and concealed it from FDR himself. So FDR goes to the convention, and there's concern about Henry Wallace. Henry Wallace is the FDR's vice president in the third term. That Wallace has become much too close to lefty influences in New York. They want to dump him. At this point, the South and the city Democrats now pretty much control the way in which the Democratic Party is functioning. And they both want to get rid of Henry Wallace. He's originally from Iowa, so he doesn't appeal to the city guys. And he's a northerner, doesn't appeal to the southern guys. And he's a liberal and doesn't part of the party's conservatives. So they want to remove him. And McCormick plays a very important role in this. He is chairman of the platform committee that year, and he helps to get his poker pal nominated for vice president. His poker pal is Harry Truman. I asked McCormick one time in one of my two interviews with him about poker pals. So I said, where was Sam Rayburn? And McCormick said, Rayburn didn't play poker. He made the sandwiches.
And Sam Rayburn was Speaker of the House for much of the 40s and 50s. And during that time, John McCormick, for a large part of that period, is House Majority Leader. You write extensively about what you call, quote, the Austin-Boston connection. What was that all about?
And these are sort of the moderate Southern Democrats, you know, like Rayburn, and the urban Catholic and ethnic Democrats from the cities, like John McCormick. And they create this alliance of the Austin-Boston connection, and they prevent the New Deal from being overturned, from being rolled back. And this is their key role during the Roosevelt years. Later, when the Democratic Party is riven by race issues, you know, the Dixiegrat walkout in 1948, and Strom Thurmond, before Southern States to vote against Harry Truman, it becomes clear that race politics has really manifested itself because so many blacks decide to leave the South and move to the cities. And they moved to the big cities, you know, Baltimore, New York, Chicago, Detroit. And those, the big cities, basically carry the big states. And if you can win the big cities, you win the big states. You win the big states, you win the Electoral College, you win the presidency. So one part is to keep the blacks, you know, connected to the Democratic Party. And then the other part is, of course, but you have to deal with the Southerners because of the seniority system. The Southerners control the committees because they've got the seniority to become the chairs of these major committees. So it's a very clear, you know, balancing act. How do you keep them together? So in 1949, John McCormick will put a racist by the name of Bill Colmer on the Rules Committee. But John McCormick also steps aside so the first African-American, Bill Dawson from Chicago, can become the first chair of a congressional committee. So McCormick is balancing, you know, the segregationists on one side and the blacks on the other. And this is what the Austin-Boston connection starts to doing during the 50s and 60s, is trying to keep these two discordant elements in the tent. And it eventually, of course, will fail with Nixon creating the Southern Strategy and basically moving, you know, Southern Democrats into the Republican Party.
Garrison, there's an interesting quote of John McCormick's. He said, if I were given a choice, I would rather be known as a good man than a great man. What do you think he meant by that?
Exactly that. He did not want to call attention to himself. He did not try to grab center stage. He was really saw his role as keeping the House together during these tough times and these discordant wings of the Democratic Party. That's where he saw himself, as being a good person.
Garrison Nelson is a political science professor at UVM. He's the author of a detailed and fascinating political biography of former U.S. House Speaker John McCormick. Garrison, many thanks for being on the program today.
Glad to do it, Bob.
That was VPR's Bob Kinzel talking in 2017 with UVM political science professor emeritus Garrison Nelson about his biography of former U.S. House Speaker John McCormick.